Hi all, co-host Morgan here with some exciting news. Team Womance, aka Isabeau and I, will be hosting a panel for Romanticy Fest on March 23rd at 11 a.m. at the Otherworld Theater in beautiful Chicago, Illinois. We'll be in conversation with Megan Mackey, author of Silver Blood Scion, Samara Brieger, author of A Long Time Dead, Melanie Michella, author of Rake Rider Series, and Tamara Giray, author of The Fall That Saved Us. We'll have mimosas and time for audience questions. So if you'd like to join for conversations about fantasy, romance, writing, reading, and of course, ourselves, you can get tickets at otherworldtheater.org/romanticy. Theater spelled T-H-E-A-T-R-E. Again, get your tickets to join the panel and tons of other great events around Romanticy like Twihard the Musical, book signings, author Q&As, and a dragon brunch at otherworldtheater.org/romanticy. Now on with our regularly scheduled programming.
I'm Isabeau.
And I'm Morgan.
And this is Womance,
a podcast about romance novels,
about ballet aspirations,
about creamy groin-vaulted ceilings,
about spending a holiday with a friend that you kind of look down on,
about foot jobs,
about beating yourself up,
about beating your wife up,
about incestuous relationships,
about getting kicked into a kaleidoscope.
But mostly it's about that first thing.
Romance novels.
And
ourselves. This week, we are very excited to discuss a listener-requested book, The Secret Heart, or No Better Angels, Book 1, by Erin Sati, S-A-T-I-E.
Sati.
And this was recommended via email by listener Lutsinka. They sent us the recommendation when they listened to our year in review and noted that Isabeau's resolution was to read weirder books. And Lutsinka felt like this was going to be a good fit for that. And this listener also has their own blog. It's lucynka.wordpress.com. And just real quick plug, if you want us to read a book, literally just ask.
Absolutely. There's 100% nothing stopping us from reading listener requests.
No, nothing stopping you and nothing stopping us. We take them via DMs. We take them via email. And if you know us like that, we take them via text message as well. So womancemail@gmail.com.
Hit us up.
Hit us up. All right, Isabeau, will you read the back of the book to help us orient towards some kind of conversation here?
Without further ado, she's a fortune hunter. He's nobody's prey. Adam, Earl of Bexley, lives to work. His only relief is the sordid savagery of bare-knuckle boxing. Not women, and definitely not a disreputable scheming woman who dances in secret. Such passion. Caro Small is desperate to escape her selfish family. Her only chance is a good marriage, and she intends to marry Adam, whether he likes it or not. But the more she schemes to entrap him, the more she risks trapping her own heart.
Oh no!
Adam won't be caught by a fortune hunter's ambitious schemes, but the vulnerable, passionate woman underneath the plots might just bring him to his knees.
Not his knees.
Well, she does that a couple of times.
Go look out. So I think there's a couple of things to talk about with our main character, Caro. One of which is that she was sort of nurtured by her dad's mistress, who was a former ballerina. And the novel is really specific about the historicity of ballet and how it was a profession for sex workers in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Not just in a way, for sure. And the art form itself is kind of inextricable from that at this time. And likewise, bare-knuckle boxing is considered this kind of savage, brutal, earthy pastime. And so they're both kind of obsessed
mm-hmm.
by these physical pursuits that are not socially acceptable for people of their class. The other thing about Caro is that she's of a very different social class. And I think that's the way this novel handled that is a little bit better than every other novel we've read, and how she kind of negotiates her relationship economically to the other characters in the books.
Absolutely. So to put that in a little bit of context, well, she is stratospheres below Adam Bexley. Mm-hmm. Her father is of the peerage. He just never sits. He's like an earl who's spent everything that wasn't nailed down. The entail, the old pile, is the only thing that is keeping the family together with its rents. But he can't touch her dowry per se. And she's got 20,000 pounds, so she's a bit of an heiress. But because she isn't in her majority, she's the tender age of 17, she doesn't control her own money. And every time she asks her father to go to the solicitor to get some funds transferred to sponsor a season, let's say, he asks for half of whatever she's taking out. Mm-hmm. So she's really cautious about spending her dowry. She wants to protect it, which makes perfect sense. She has a little bespectacled intellectual brother that she also wants to send to school.
Naturally. And two older, whoremongering, fisticuffs.
Bad brothers
who are just like their father.
Wastrels.
Yeah. Caro finds herself at this home because of her special knowledge of that she acquires as someone who is not living the same way the rest of the peerage would expect. So her friend Daphne is engaged after the season that they share, Daphne and Caro. She gets engaged to this guy, and Caro finds out through her brothers that this guy has the pox, which I think is syphilis.
Yeah, it's the incurable one.
Yeah. And so she informs Daphne. She's frank with her about it, lets her know the deal. And Daphne lets her cousin Adam, who is, you may have heard of from earlier in the episode when Isabel read the back of the book, and he gets her out of this engagement. And for that reason, Caro wins their trust, but also their suspicion. So the thing that makes her useful is also the thing that makes her an outsider.
Sets her apart.
When she arrives at this house.
It endears suspicion in Adam, who is to inherit a dukedom.
Yeah. I think he thinks Caro at worst is going to be a really bad influence on his beloved cousin Daphne. And he might be right about that.
Sure.
Because what Daphne seems to appreciate about Caro is that she has a certain dynamism about her. And indeed, at one point in the novel, Daphne and her have a confrontation. Daphne says, like, why do you think I keep you around? It's because you're not trustworthy. It's because you have this edge about you. But we know internally that Caro really wants to be a regular gal, a good girl. And that's kind of one of the central problems of this novel is the idea that Caro is a bad girl. In fact, it's part of this series that's supposed to revolve around bad heroines.
No Better Angels is the subtitle of the series.
What do you...
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask you what you thought.
I was like, thou dost protest too much. One, Caro 17.
Ooh.
No one's been protecting her whole life. Mm-hmm. Her mom died when her bespectacled intellectual little brother was born. She's just been in the clutches of a family that's like degrading around her by the choices of her dad and her older brothers. She has this beloved sort of governess, sort of mother step-in creature, human, and Giselle, the former ballerina, who is then both hired help in the home and also mistress. And I thought, like, the book doesn't understand Caro as a no better angel. It doesn't even understand her as, like, I didn't even think of her as, like, particularly edgy. All of her choices seemed totally earned.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, she's also not just thinking of herself. Like, and that would have been justified, in my opinion, right? Where she's like, my mom set this money away for me. It's for me to live. I see how vulnerable people I love, like Giselle, are. I don't want that for myself. But she was also really, really concerned about baby bro's ability to have glasses. And he's, like, bullied at school and, like...
Well, his ability to go to school. He wants to be a vicar.
Right. And so, like, none of her actions are even purely for herself. She's like, she definitely thinks of winning the ticket of a good marriage as a way to protect her baby brother. And so, like, the subtitle does protest too much.
I want to go back to that, but I think what the book intends as the rub is the fact that Caro is a fortune hunter. She decides, like, she has this moment of realization that Adam wants her. And she's like, okay, this is like my best, perhaps last chance. And definitely by far and away my best chance. He's a duke.
And she reads him as an honorable man. So she's like, if I put him in a compromising position, yeah, his honor will demand that he marry me.
Yeah. She decides that she's going to make this happen. The rub for me is that she's very honest about it.
Mm-hmm.
She gives Adam all sorts of outs. Now, whether or not those outs are entirely useful in his mental state, I don't know. But she does offer them, which and I think is kind of the best she can do. And so I wanted to talk about this question of, like, doth protest too much. What do you mean about that, by that?
I mean, like, she's a fortune hunter, sure. But, like, the softest kind, like, she's not even, like, she doesn't want to be a duchess. She doesn't, like, want to, she doesn't even talk about rising in rank or any of those things. Like, she's not particularly interested in the trappings. She's just really interested in safety and security and, like, guaranteeing a good life for her younger brother. And in all of those ways that, like, that feels like good heroine TMTM. And also, mm-hmm, like, her specialized knowledge, because her brothers are wastrels and she knows what the pox is and how you get it. And, like, she deploys that knowledge to help Daphne out of what would have been a terrible situation, right? Like, Daphne would have then contracted, yeah, syphilis, a deadly disease. And, like, it would have been bad. And so she, like, takes, yeah, it upon herself to then out herself to Daphne, knowing that Daphne's, like, a bad secret keeper. And, like, yeah, so she knows how she's being perceived at the palatial palace of the Duke and his heir. And, like, all of those are, like, calculated risks, but they never feel, like, particularly calculated for, like, her own mercurial benefit.
Hmm. I can see how she's contextually bad.
Sure.
Which is mostly down to, like, knowledge that she has gained, not of her own accord. But I think the thing that people find interesting or difficult or challenging to read about isn't really contextually bad women. I would say the majority of historical romance heroines written in the 21st century are bad for their in their context. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, the only real challenge would perhaps be the fact that she's a fortune hunter, but she does it so perfectly. It's hard to, like, pin that as what makes her bad. What makes her interesting, and I do think she's interesting, is the way she calculates and her calculus. And the thing about that, the economics of this text, is that she's really thinking about her situation holistically, mm-hmm, in terms of safety, in terms of comfort, in terms of literal exit pathways. When she's confronted by would-be attackers, she's always calculating. And for that reason, it's interesting to remain in her head. But she's not the kind of, she's not like the main character in Beast by Judith Ivory, who is just a regular, degular bad person who is, like, truly selfish and shallow and pining for the wrong things. Caro is none of that.
Yeah, Caro has eyes wide open, which makes it hard for, I think, part of the problem of me seeing her as, like, a quote unquote bad girl is that, like, her choices are earned. They're deeply understandable. She's transparent about them. She's never obfuscating what she's doing. So there's, like, no deceit.
Yeah.
And I think the deceit would be the thing that would make her a quote unquote bad girl.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's just truly absent.
That's interesting. Like, deceit versus manipulation. And where does that line get drawn? Because she's definitely manipulating.
Sure.
Adam. And his family.
But he knows that he's being manipulated. And so then it's, like, the first step in avoiding a trap is knowing there is one.
Yeah.
And he's, like, calling her out all the time. He's like, I see what you're doing. And she's like, okay.
Yes, you do.
Good job.
But he seems to not really, believe it. There's this scene when he first kisses her
mm-hmm.
and realizes exactly how young she is
mm-hmm.
and innocent. And she also just gets the flutterbuzz and doesn't know what to do with herself and is kind of overwhelmed by her project in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Her project of seduction has like real stakes all of a sudden.
Yeah. Where before it had just been theory. And I thought that was like a particularly interesting way of embodying her backstory
mm-hmm.
where it's like she does, like, in Adam's perspective, she does have like the wiles and flirtations of someone much older and someone much more experienced.
Yeah.
And so when he accepts the invitation of her flirtation and discovers that she is wholly innocent,
yeah,
which, like, her reaction to his kiss, he's like, you don't know what you're doing. You don't know what you're getting into. And she has this sort of revelatory moment of like, holy shit, like, this is what it is to be like in my body physically and like to feel that enacted by another person.
Mm-hmm. Her ballet, she talks about it, is about like creating, what is it? Perfect, like a perfect system or something.
Mm-hmm. It's like an out of body experience for her that is true. Mechanized perfection, where it's like,
yeah,
my muscles do this when I tell them to in this way, which leads yeah. to this outcome. And it's like predictable, beautiful, like otherworldly,
controllable.
Yes.
Whereas getting kissed by a cute fella gives you a whole different set
can't
of
control it.
Physical sensations.
Mm-hmm.
And this book, like, really lives in physical sensation. Do you want to say your favorite word?
What's my favorite word? Embodiment?
No.
What's my favorite word?
Don't act like you don't know.
What's my favorite word? I don't know.
Corporeal.
Oh, yeah, I do like that word.
Once per episode. So
that's right.
I think this book actually rises to that level. I was thinking about how, like, the interiority of the characters.
Mm-hmm.
Or their exteriority is described via their own interiority for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, in other romance novels, people are thinking about how they feel, how the other person looks. And the characters in this novel are, both Adam and Caro, are thinking about how it feels to be in within their bodies and what effect the other person has on their body, but also what effect they have on their body.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all a reflection of this external turmoil
mm-hmm.
that they have going on around them.
Yeah. I think maybe more than any book in recent memory, this is a text where both characters are not at all interested really in interrogating their feelings and use their bodies to run away from bad feeling.
Yeah.
It was refreshing to read about, just like all those ways, like, their emotional reactions come as surprises to them because they're just not particularly versed or like reflective in that way because they're avoiding it
yeah.
and using his boxing as a way to like deal with his bad feeling about his dad and like inheriting a big title and not feeling in control. And she uses ballet to escape a bad situation, but like they're using physicality to escape bad feeling.
Yes.
And so then to have that flipped where it's like they're not in control of how their body feels around each other
mm-hmm.
creates a kind of inner turmoil that neither is particularly like well-versed to handle.
Yeah. The thing that strikes me about what you were just saying is the experience of reading it, it allows the reader to get distracted from the true feelings of
mm-hmm.
the characters as well, because the physicality is so real. It grounds you deeply in their person. Like you physically feel it, you know,
mm-hmm.
muscles and toes and churning and all that, sweeping,
pliés,
all those sensations.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows the reader to be likewise surprised by the feelings the characters have. I mean, we're kind of like, we can only do that so much. We can only be surprised so much because this is a romance novel.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that they actually do like each other, but
mm-hmm.
having it unfold and having each of them realize it and cope creates a really great technique for dramatic irony, which I would have never thought of before.
I think cope is exactly the right word for these two beautiful dummies.
Can we talk about weirdest part? Because I want to get
sure.
into your weirdest part, especially as it relates to bodies.
It does. Do you just want me to like...
Let her rip.
All right, dude. This girl be 17.
Mm-hmm.
I am deeply fucking weirded out by that. One, because 17 is so fucking young. Even by, like, yeah, your first season, like, out, like, historical accuracy, whatever. But, like, whatever. This book was written in 2014. 17 is fucking young.
Yeah.
We could have aged her up a bit. And she seems so much older than most of the people around her.
Yeah.
So then anytime that I'm violently reminded of her age, I'm like...
Not to mention all the explicit sex on page.
So much very explicit sex.
Between the 17-year-old and like 20-something.
Like 28. Like, it's not good. It's
28, it's, surely not, right?
I mean, whatever he was sub-30, but like not sub-sub. He had already had a grand tour, which means that he'd graduated Oxford or Cambridge.
Yeah. Ugh. Oh, man.
Yeah, I don't want to do the math. He's sub-30.
The only good number here would have been 17. And even then, it's like, okay, don't.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the other thing you're pointing out, she seems so much older. Like, what is the point of making her 17?
Like, what does that do for us? And, like, that's another part of this, like, No Better Angels subtitle that doesn't work. It's she's truly too young to have done anything so terrible or even have, like, I don't know. She's not, like, she's not even a brat. Like, she's not even unintentional. She's incredibly intentional. Mm. And, like, that's another part of, like, her thinking and, like, being in her head and being in her embodiment. It's like she's not thinking about her feelings. She's incredibly pragmatic.
Yeah.
And for a 17-year-old to be that pragmatic feels weird. But also, I hate that she's 17. It's fucking gross.
Yeah, I feel like she could have just as easily been. And I recognize that, like, the age of legal consent is a great deal arbitrary.
Sure.
25 is when your frontal lobe starts forming, right? Like, when that gets finalized.
Yes.
So 18 feels, you know, pretty arbitrary. But, I mean, what would be the harm in making her 19 even?
Or 21, right? All of those ages are still younger than the age of majority, which, because the stakes of this mm-hmm. is that she can't access her dowry, mm-hmm. 25 is the age of majority. Put her anywhere between 18 and 24, and we still have someone who's like, it's like, it sucks less.
Yeah. And, like, I think the why of this is clued into her actual body, and I'm afraid to say, I think it's the worst reason possible that she's 17. Because, like, think, like, I would say even they could have made her 22 and talked about how she had her season like 4 or 5 years ago and she hasn't been able to bring herself to spend the money yet. And she's, you know, actually at like a point of crisis,
yeah,
in her future. But the way she feels her actual form, so how she looks to other people, and of course how she looks to other people, the main thing about her is she's small, and the smallness is perversely drooled over more so here than in any Kathleen Woodowis novel, which I feel is like the standard for making me feel uncomfortable about how great a small wrist is.
A svelte little body.
Yeah. I want to find an example, if you don't mind.
Please do. It's actively skeevy.
Skeezy is right. And it talks about other people around her being actively skeezy. Like, Adam gets very irritated when his cousin addresses her as Caroline Small, which is her last name, but all in italics, mm-hmm. and he, like, eyebrow raises. But at the same time, when he, like, flops his erection on her stomach, he reflects that he's never looked so big.
Yeah.
She, at one point, is, like, completely crouching. Her entire body is crouched on his chest like a fairy.
Like, even in their first instance of, yeah, having sex, when he's like, you'll grow to like it, when he's referring to his penis and she's like unimpressed.
I did like that she was like, oh, this isn't cute.
This isn't what I like. And he's like, you'll grow to like it. And I'm like, will she?
What do you mean?
I just, you know, like, that's an assumption on his part that I wasn't like.
That she'll come to enjoy looking at penises.
Yeah. Or that, like, it'll be his or her favorite part. Hang on. There's another weird part about this.
About what?
This whole sex scene. This first sex scene really breaks the rule because it was not my 60s party.
Okay.
Because there's so much fucking weirdness. There is this, so like we've talked about the turmoil of the characters and how they're not particularly good at their own emotions. And this book is really, really good at it. And so I'd like to read a part to you if that's okay.
In the sex scene?
It's right after.
Okay.
So they're having sex outside. This is the big seduction so that he'll marry her.
Mm-hmm.
During the penetrative portion of the sex act, she says no,
mm-hmm.
because she's like it's too intense. She's feeling too much. She sees that she's being trapped by her feelings for him rather than being in control of the situation.
Yeah.
But he doesn't have any of that access to her thinking. So he hears no, hears her say it a second time and immediately stops because he thinks that she is no longer consenting, which is the correct assumption on his part. And then they have this like awful little denouement where he's like, I'm sorry. And she's like, don't be sorry. And like all this other stuff. And then he goes to his room to clean up. And also like tangentially, he's like rendered a man unconscious in the boxing ring and may have killed him. So he's feeling a lot of stuff.
Yeah, he's got a lot going on.
She'd been willing, more than willing. She'd been so determined to see her plot through that she'd lain beneath him silent and miserable while he retted over her all the time. He'd assumed that they were connected, united as one, straining toward a common end. She'd been separate in her own world and he hadn't even noticed. He felt simultaneously monstrous and used, irredeemably evil and betrayed, criminal and victim.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, this is such a good encapsulation of, and like, this is like, I serve on a Title IX disciplinary board. That encapsulation of that feeling is 100% everything that I see young men say. It was bananas to have it written for this character in this way, because it was like so true.
Like Title IX, like they've been brought up for some kind of sexual misconduct and they're saying,
I was used, I'm the victim.
Yeah.
I've been betrayed.
Yeah. Betrayed in the sense that like I thought she actually wanted to or something like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they can't face the guilt of how bad they feel about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's that reverb where it's like, you're the villain for bringing this case against me. You're the villain for making me feel bad because I don't want to feel this way.
Yeah.
Criminal and victim.
I think it's important to note that Adam, when she started saying no, he did stop. Like,
yes,
they do
absolutely
not finish. And he talks about how he'll probably never forget the sound of being inside a woman who's saying no.
Yep.
And she is very much consenting. We are in her perspective through the story. And good for Adam for saying, this is a confusing situation, so I'm getting out of it.
Yep. He did everything right.
And his feelings, yep. And his feelings were hurt. And it is like a heartbreaking thing. But yeah, you're right. Like, this is the emotional space of people who have harmed others.
And he's afraid to face that about himself because he doesn't want to be the kind of person who harms others, especially those that he perceives as more vulnerable.
Yeah.
And so like all of that is in service of making Adam a good character, right? Like he should feel bad. Like it makes sense that he would. It makes sense that he has these really intense feelings, but just the contrast of like criminal and victim, like the one who was betrayed, like all of it was just like, oh my God, this person has really talked to somebody or like is really good at imagining like the hetero cis male perspective on this particular thing. Cause like nailed it.
Well, is that so hard to imagine?
No, it's not. But I think for me, like it's so succinct. It's, and the emotional like charge of it based on how we were in her head during the sex scene, how it and so abruptly and then we're immediately in his bad feeling.
Yeah.
It was like, it was, I mean, for a book that isn't, that whose characters are not particularly interested in their emotional interiority, like kaboom.
His like, articulation was like wrenching.
Yes, wrenching is the right word.
I agree. I felt very wrenched by that. he's at odds with wanting to be a good person, and that meaning taking responsibility for your choices, but also not being the person who perpetrated bad choices. And mm-hmm. I think that's what he's wrestling with in front of the fireplace. And I think that it's interesting that he takes it to the place of consensual sex with Caro, because I think it is worth noting that in the context of this book, their tryst isn't bad because it's sex. Their tryst is bad because they were both unemotionally prepared for what it meant mm-hmm. and weren't really dealing with that part of it first. I think is if the novel faults them for anything mm-hmm. in that scene, it's that. But he literally punched a guy to unconsciousness. Like, not just like, oop, he's out for a little bit. Like, he was...
No, he's out stone cold.
Out. He was possibly going to starve to death because his face was so mauled. Mm-hmm. And it's not so different from his sex scene with Caro, that first sex scene, in that everyone encourages his alter ego, Mumbles the Boxer, to get in the ring with this champion from London. He's like, yeah, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. I'm going to prove something. And he makes punching this guy about resolving all of his other shortcomings. And he's interesting as a character because he struggles with his mediocrity, in that he's only so rebellious against his very evil father, and he's only so patient with his family, and he's only like, he has all of these limits that he creates for himself. In the beginning of the novel, his boxing opponent tells him that he needs to be meaner. Mm-hmm. And his trainer explains to him, like, you've got to punch, you've got to aim for their nose, like you want your fist to come out of the back of their skull. You got to go all in on it. And so he decides he's going to go all in. Likewise, Caro decides she's going to go all in. And she is likewise reckless and unprepared and goes way too far. She's sitting under a tree waiting for him to come stumbling out of this arena in her most seductive little ballerina outfit. And I think she really fucks him up. And I think she like doesn't know, just like he wasn't really prepared. He could like conceptualize of the stakes. He didn't really grasp them. I think she was in the same boat. Like at one point she's like giggling and like thinking about other things and like sitting on his lap, thinking about how funny it is to like lick someone. Mm-hmm. But she's having a very real effect on him. Mm-hmm. And one that's undermining his own, maybe even his own autonomy. Like he's drunk. He literally had tons of drinks, and after winning the boxing match, and he's been punched drunk, and mm-hmm. he's not in his right mind, and she's just letting her rip. It's hard to think of her that way because she is so ethereal.
She's ethereal, but even in that scene, she gives him a series of outs, and like
all the time.
When he comes back and he's worried that he's killed a man, she stops seducing him and moves into comfort. Mm-hmm. And then they like strike up again. And like the back and forth of this particular sex scene is like, the pacing is so good. The moves are so good. She gives him a series of outs. He doesn't really want them, which is why he doesn't take them. Yeah. It's like, and they also really just genuinely like each other.
And it's got this like flutteriness of discovery all about it. This mm-hmm. hazy glow of late night drunkenness. It has all of that. Plus it's making these kind of calculated plot moves. Mm-hmm.
It's a very strong scene.
It's a strong scene, but it's not the sexiest scene. Certainly not.
No.
I think I want to talk about this. Okay. So this is from Adam's perspective. He's reflecting on when he first met Daphne and her tiny little body. And this is my weirdest part. Isabeau's is that she's 17. Mine is the obsession with her smallness and the way her etherealness works throughout the book. So Adam, in his perspective, he'd never seen anything more beautiful than her slim silhouette, arms upraised as she filled her cupped hands with water from the fountain. And the way she moved, graceful and lithe, the angle of her head and the slope of her shoulder so perfect, they filled him with a violent soul-deep yearning. I wonder if I've ever filled anyone with a violent soul-deep yearning. And if I haven't, I feel like I'm running out of time.
Think you just need to bend over a fountain and cup your hands.
I've done that. I don't. And I don't think any violent soul-deep yearning followed me. How could she be so reckless? Catching her outside had been like watching someone knock delicate porcelain vases off a tabletop. Be careful with that, he'd wanted to shout, with the small difference that pottery didn't give him an erection.
Nice.
It's funny. Also, this book has a couple of really good funny lines.
It does. It's very, the comedic timing is quite good.
But it's just her like smallness and her tininess. And when we're first in her perspective and she's doing this sylph ballet dance, well, she's doing her drills and then she's doing her sylph ballet. Talks about her like losing her body, becoming like air. It's Mr. Rochester's dream scenario. She's like without form and without figure. And then after she has sex with Adam, she finds herself incapable of doing this dance. And eventually she makes her way back to her ballet teacher / governess / mom. And she does that dance for her. And she says, you can never do that dance again. And she feels like clunky and restricted. Like she is, like there's something about having sex with Adam that seals her into her body.
Yes.
And it's so weird to me. Like, I don't know what the point of that was. I don't see where it goes besides, like, it feels like when I had sex ed and they were like, you're in a public school and they told me my virginity was a treasure.
They told me mine was like masking tape. And the more you like peeled your masking tape off and put it on other people, the less sticky it got.
The less sticky it got.
Mm-hmm. The less able to be what it is supposed to be. Like me, like I am the masking tape and I like
can't stick anymore. I can see how that would work in that you like leave a little bit of yourself and pick up a little bit of them, you know, kind of explains maybe some STIs.
I mean, maybe.
And then you put a condom on a piece of masking tape and you're like, look, nothing's sticking forever. And it's not sticking to anything except the condom.
Yeah, that was definitely not the interpretation that Coach Gray gave us.
And then you tape a little mini progesterone pill to it. And you're like, see, it can still stick stuff. It's still doing the sticky thing, even though it's on birth control.
Yep.
Yeah, that's what they should have done. No, they just told me mine was a treasure.
When you said that she's sealed in her body, one of the things that like I kept thinking throughout this text is like, why is his name Adam?
Very first man.
Exactly.
He is.
But like also being sealed into your body via sex is also incredibly biblical, right?
And, it is.
And they have sex outside underneath a tree. Oh. She's coming into knowledge. You know, I think there's something about that.
Ugh.
And to use my favorite word, like when you're sealed into your corporeality.
She loses her grace.
She loses something essential. And I think like that fucking sucks. And I don't think the book knows what to do with it. And I think it tries to understand what she loses is like heartbreak. Or control, like once you like love someone like that, yeah. You do lose an essential sense of control. But the way that it's written in the text itself is like, it feels like a really intense consequence.
Maybe it's not. Maybe this is us overvaluing cerebrality in our own lives, that could be. Though, because it seems like it seems like maybe she loses the ability to suspend her body into her mind, right? Or supersede her body with her mind. And when she has sex with him, that becomes impossible. That becomes difficult because she's sealed into her body or what have you. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
It seems like a loss.
It feels like a loss. Yeah, she's bad at dancing. But she does come up with new choreography.
Mm-hmm.
And she does a sexy little dance by a bathtub later on.
She absolutely does.
You ready to talk about sexiest part?
Well, I think we're all going to talk about that scene.
I don't know. You go ahead. I've got a different one in mind. Can you believe it?
Oh, no. You didn't choose the bathtub scene?
No.
Okay.
Expected of me, and I refuse. I'm choosing to zag when I usually zig towards a bathtub.
Well, I fell right into that copper steaming tub.
It's a very sexy scene. It's not... Listeners, it's not what you expect.
It's so sexy. Like, you know, because she wants to have a bath because she's sweaty because she's been doing her drills. And like, I would love to set the scene because I don't even know if the sex is the sexiest part of that. Mm-hmm. So much as like the voyeurism. Mm. So like she's doing these drills.
Exactly. 100%. Mm-hmm.
Adam's put her in the dower house where she's both nursing the person that he knocked out, who's been unconscious for several days at this point, and also to keep her away from his baroquely evil father. Mm-hmm. And so she's doing her drills by candlelight. And he's like coming from the big house and he's just watching her as she like does her drills and as she like tucks in Ed Harris, the boxer. And
not
then she,
the
like,
actor.
Not the actor. That's why I said the boxer. And like, you know, and because we're in his perspective, watching her do her drills, watching her take care of the unconscious boxer, like watching her maneuver through the dower house, he's maneuvering around the house mm-hmm. to watch her through these like big windows, like this like sad little puppy / weird stalker. And like uh-huh. his joy in her is so fucking hot. It's just so hot.
Well, his joy in her, like while she's bathing herself in order to purposefully be seductive, he starts masturbating.
Yeah, he can't contain himself because he has been thinking about
he can't contain his joy. I guess not.
Around the house. But I'm saying like this scene takes so long because it starts outside and then he comes inside and she's like basically gonna fall down. So then he picks her up and then she like cuddles into him. And it like it doesn't even like seem like sex is on the table at that point.
Yeah.
And because she's so sleepy because she's been working so hard. And then, you know, she's like, you could carry me everywhere. And he's like, I could carry you everywhere because you're itty bitty, which is gross. But like they have this whole little scene. And he's like, you're dirty. Like you should wash. You're sweaty. Like, you know, and then she like steps over and at first it's not sexy. But then she notices him noticing her. And then she like feels a permission structure to put on a show. It hadn't occurred to her before. And so like that's her own discovery. And then she's deeply in control of the scene and, you know, controlling the sex. And then they move to the bed. It's like fucking end to end. It's a feast.
Dude, we have got to get out of Hyde Park feeling a performance structure or a permission structure to perform.
I am what I am.
But it's very hot.
Oh my God, it was so hot. It was ridiculous.
I picture him very clearly as he's short, mm-hmm. super muscly. Mm-hmm. It talks regularly about his short fingers, messed up knuckles. He's got blonde, golden-y hair and like mm-hmm. bright gold hazel eyes. I was picturing very clearly Jeremy Allen White. Mm-hmm. No mm-hmm. longer White Boy of the Month, but he was for 1 month White Boy of the mm-hmm. Month. The thing is about romance novels is women just want what they want, even when it's not trendy, quote unquote.
Yeah.
They'll celebrate any body type, but only one kind of female body type, and that is childlike.
Yeah, it's gross. I'm like, and also for such a good book, it's like, so why have this particular Kathleen Woodowis throwback? Like Daphne is incredibly tall and like sort of whatever. She also she can't be that much older than Caro because they share a season. But like part of what I think is even grosser.
They talk about Elizabeth, who is extremely buxom and womanly, but she's also like the bad
exactly.
idiot
I was like
one.
Part of the grossness of Caro's smallness and litheness and childlikeness is that it, in comparison to the major other female characters, it's like that's part of what makes her quote unquote like good or desirable, because Elizabeth is buxom but too sexual and in fact is in an incestuous relationship with her stepson.
Yeah. But Caro is also observed to be a little overly flirtatious. Mm-hmm. By everyone around her. And she is flirting a lot. I think it's interesting to go back to the body thing. Caro, when she's doing her bar exercises in the beginning, she loved the feel of her body doing what she told it, when she told it, how she told it, obedient, with her leg turned out, her arm bent just so, her head turned up, She felt like she transcended her own flesh. Mm-hmm. And it's like that sense of control, that bodily control. And I think it is like later on we hear from Adam, like he is highly restricting his diet so that he can lose mm-hmm. weight. He is exercising a lot and toning his muscles and like doing all of this. And he's not even getting paid to box. Like this mm-hmm. is his hobby. And I've always thought about that. There are people who really intensely train. Like I get like it feels good training all the time. But why are you eating just like chicken breast and broccoli? Why are you doing the cutting part? Like you don't have like no one's greasing you up on a Saturday in a convention center and judging you. Like, why is this part of it for you? And it seems like it's not that far removed from, you know, eating, disordered eating, full stop. And it sounds like what Caro is doing here is kind of through the same motivations, like this intense desire for control that leads to being incredibly rooted in your body. I don't relate to that since I mostly try to control things in my head. But I think it is striking that after she has sex with him, it sort of starts to fall apart. Mm-hmm. Is that supposed to be like some indicator that they're like in love and love is making them better?
I think that's one way the book wants us to understand it. What was your sexiest part?
I'm glad you asked. I'm gonna read it.
Okay.
So they're having afternoon tea, and this is because Adam is on a really restrictive diet, but Daphne wants them all to spend time together around some kind of meal. So she starts an afternoon tea where Adam doesn't have to eat with the family. Cool. So someone breaks a cookie and everyone freaks out. Her nose itched and she glanced up instinctively, locking eyes with Bexley. His were hooded, knowing, the color of warm treacle. Mm. While Caro blushed into her lap, the door opened to admit Lord Paul. Afternoon, Bexley. Daphne, Miss, Lord Paul winked at Sir Walter. Small. Caro bit back a retort. Bexley left his untouched tea on the mantle and circled around to stand behind Caro. One of his hands, gloved now, dropped onto the settee's carved wooden spine. Caro inched forward on the seat, farther away from that hand. Enough, Uncle, warned Bexley in a cold, sharp voice. Eastbourne may be quiet now, but better transportation will change that. Bexley leaned a little closer to Caro. Deliberately, she realized, she scooted even farther away, bracing her feet against the floor to keep from falling from the cushion. While the new arrivals settled down and Daphne queried them about their tea, Sir Walter scooted closer to Bexley and pitched his voice low. Perhaps we ought to push back our construction dates. Absolutely not, Bexley slashed at the air. I'd be glad to hear what Miss Small thinks of Iron Gate, said Bexley, now that she's had a little time to explore. I think it might take years to get to know this house, Caro laughed. In any case, I spent the morning out of doors with Daphne. Daphne stood abruptly. Caro, didn't you ask me for a tour of Iron Gate? She followed Daphne from the room, but paused at the threshold to take a look back. Bexley stared down at the now empty sofa, one hand stroking along the spot on the cushion her back had never quite touched. A thought came to her then, and it was so strange, so incongruous, that she wanted to disown it, send it back to where it had come from. Anyways, my sexiest part is when he strokes the the sofa.
So good. Yeah, it's very Darcy handing Elizabeth into the carriage.
It's very good. It's very good.
It's very good.
It's well done. I like that she's so anxious and trying to get away mm-hmm. from him the whole time because mm-hmm. he seems so at odds with her. Mm-hmm. So strict. And she's strict herself. It's just everyone understands her as like a hoyden of some sort.
Right.
It's one of those kinds of books where people stroke sofas.
Yeah.
The sofa stroking book.
Which means that this listener really knew how to stroke our sofa.
It really did. It stroked our sofa. This was a romance for me.
Absolutely. Hands down. I read it. And like listeners know that I have a young child. And like I was up too late reading this book because I couldn't put it down. I just loved being with these two beautiful, stupid dummies.
I just wanted them to figure it out. And spoiler alert, they do.
They do.
We didn't even get into like the villainy of the bad dad, truly bad dad. And we stayed away.
Truly bad dad.
But you know what? Yeah. We got incorporeal, and Isabel got to mention she stayed up late reading. Mm-hmm. So I think 2 out of 3 ain't bad.
It's true. It's true.
I think we can call this one an episode.
In its truest form. Yeah.
Yes.
It is the Seon form of romance.
The platonic ideal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for bringing this. If you would like to stroke our sofas and scintillate our brains,
yeah,
you know where to find us. Womancemail@gmail.com or on our website.
If you don't, the exiting credits will let you know.
Sure will.
Exiting credits, closing credits.
Whatever. The thing that we do at the end.
The thing we do at the end.
With that, loosen your stays.
But never your principles.
Mwah!
Woly guacamole, everyone. Thanks for listening to another episode of Womance.
Womance is hosted and produced by my friend Morgan.
And by my friend Isabel. Our logo artwork is by another friend, Mary Reichman. You can find her on Instagram at m.reichman, spelled R-E-I-S-C-H-M-A-N-N.
Original music by Nick Gravlin.
Editing and mixing for this episode was done by Steve Keel.
And our web mistress is Jane Bonzak. They're the best.
You're also the best. We so appreciate your support by listening. Please consider taking this to the next level by following, rating, and reviewing. We read every single review. Or even check us out on Patreon.
If you'd like more woe in your life, you can connect with us on Instagram at womance and on Twitter where we are @mance_woe. Or you can find more episodes and content at womancepodcast.com.
If you have an idea or just want to reach out, please email womancemail@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
Womance is a part of the Frolic Podcast Network. Find more podcasts to add to your romance collection at frolic.media/podcasts. Until next time.
We want to take a second to thank you for supporting Womance by listening to our podcast.
One great way that you can continue supporting us, including those listens, is hitting subscribe, telling a friend, leaving a review. That stuff all really matters.
Sharing it on your personal social media is another great way to spread the word about Womance. And another option for supporting us, if we may be so bold, is to recommend going to our Patreon, where you can donate as little as $1 a month to help us spread the word of woe.
If you want to contribute more than $1 a month, which obviously no pressure, whatever you've got, we are so appreciative to have. But we have awesome gifts for you. If you want a hand-addressed letter from Morgan and Isabeau, maybe with some special woe stickers, other merch.
Just visit our Patreon. We are Womance on Patreon, or is it patreon.com/womance? We would be very proud to call you one of our patrons.